Hi, it's Diane. It is February 18th and I'm here with the I have no idea what day it is. Wait, it's Thursday. It's the Thursday at noon group. Yay. So far we have Shelley and Mia, and so let's start with celebrations and check-ins. Who wants to go first?
This is Shelley. I can go first.
Thanks.
A celebration for us is one of our challenges is Matt's organization and using some of the organizational tools back and forth to school. And we were actually just on vacation, and so very much got out of the routine of things. And when we came back, there were, you know, just a small bump or two in the getting back into the routine, and now this week he's just like skyrocketed with it and is really making sure that he's using his planner and his checklist that he has, and really working hard to, you know, catch up on any work and get everything turned in once he gets to school. And so that's been really exciting this week and rewarding, not only for me, but I can see it in him too, like that he's excited that he's, you know, using it and getting it. So that's been good. And I guess where we're at, I was looking at the topic for today, and one of my goals is also to become that reformed yeller, and I've been doing pretty good, and I think this curiosity topic will be very interesting in helping me continue to not focus so much on, you know, whatever it is that is triggering me and finding out what else is going on. So I've had, you know, moments of still yelling, but I feel like I'm getting better. So that's kind of where
well,
we're
that's
at.
And that's something to celebrate. And what I would tell you is that it's kind of two sides of it. So use curiosity to stay untriggered, and then use curiosity to manage your triggers. And we'll talk more about that. So you'll be curious on top of curious. How's that sound, Shelley?
Sounds good.
Awesome, Mia. What about you?
Oh, sorry, guys, I have a speaker. I'm also a person of yeller working on being reformed, Shelley. So I broke my leg a couple of weeks ago. So this has really resulted in a lot of interesting challenges, having never broken a bone before. I'm non-weight-bearing. So my husband is having to do the lion's share of the work. And I'm sort of an observer in my own house in a lot of situations, because I'm literally like sitting in a corner of the living room with my leg elevated most of the time and watching our morning routine go on like live theater. And I have to say it's going really well. The kids know what they need to do and are able to kind of problem solve in the moment. Like, okay, a little gross, but when my son didn't find any clean sweatpants, he got a pair out of his hamper and he came out and he was so proud of himself. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Ew. But good problem solving. you solved it.
Exactly.
I was really proud of that. But a couple weeks ago, we were really focusing on compassion and how compassion for our children is one challenge. Compassion for ourselves is another challenge. And for me, I took aim at compassion for my husband because he's managing so much in the moment, and trying to express gratitude for all of the help that and all the things he's doing for me, especially now, and the weight that he's carrying on my behalf. And have really seen a lot more opening up, like kind of debriefing the end of the day and helping to process, you know, what worked, what didn't, what could we do differently tomorrow that would set us up for success better. And it's kind of a different pitch of the conversation. And he just started attending a parenting class by Dr. Shapiro on managing complex kids, an in-person lecture series. And he came home saying all the things that you guys have said to him and, you know, all the books we have on our bookshelf, but I was proud of myself for not saying, see, I told you so.
It's so hard to do that, isn't it?
It was so hard. But it was like, wow, this is what clicked for him. He also has dyslexia and probably on the autism spectrum. So just realizing this as an adult is a whole set of challenges, but I was able to demonstrate compassion for his challenges and celebrate with him that it's clicking for him, and he's seeing the difference his behavior is making. So sorry, that's a long check-in, and it's really not about the kids. But as parents, if we can change our behavior, it has such an effect on the kids. So So,
interesting.
All right,
The workshop, I'm just curious where Dr. Shapiro was and if there's an opportunity there. I would love to talk to you at some point about whether you think that there's a good connection. We're always looking for great resources because there are some people who love face-to-face and they want to be there in somebody's audience,
yeah.
And it's always nice when you find somebody who's speaking the same language. So if
yeah,
you want to pass that on, I would love to get it.
Happy to share that with you. He's in Rockville, Maryland. He does the D.C. area, so he uses Ross Green's Explosive Child, Superflex, basically kids with a whole array
yeah.
of challenges. ADHD is one of his most common ones, but it travels together with dyslexia and autism spectrum and a lot of other things. So a lot of nice research-based stuff there and a lot of alignment with your program. So it's a happy thing when everyone's speaking off the same script, essentially. And yeah, so.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that. Okay, good. Well, I'll make a note. If you can send me something, that would be great, Mia. Let me just double check and see if anybody else joined. No, just the two of you guys. It's going to be a small group today. I'm excited. It's always nice to have a more intimate conversation. So let's loop back and say, Shelley, where do you want to take aim this week? And I don't know whether you already know kind of where you want to be taking, focusing on curiosity. It doesn't really necessarily matter, but just what particular challenge do you want to kind of keep in mind as we have this conversation about curiosity?
Well, I have been working with my son to, what I usually do is, like I said, the organization piece is huge for us. What I usually do is I look at, like, our portal for school. Is he missing any work? What assignments are coming up next? And so I've been working on that with him to try to transition that to him because I think it helps tie in with why he writes the stuff down in his binder, because then eventually it becomes a grade on that portal. And so I have been doing that with him this past 2 weeks, week and a half since we came home from our trip. And the fact that it's on a computer, he likes that, so he's more interested in it than a sheet of paper and his pencil that he writes down at school on his planner. And so trying to continue to have him do that and connect that to his planner. Like, that's what I want to help.
So let's go back and so can I challenge you, Shelley, to take it up a level and say,
yeah,
what problem are you trying to solve? Because the planner is a solution rather than a challenge. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
The
so problem, what problem are you trying to solve?
The problem I'm trying to solve is I want him to take more ownership for his schoolwork. Whether that's getting it done or turning it in, it's all of those things. So that I want it to be his responsibility, not mine.
So you're trying to help him to take. Remind me again how old Matt is.
He is going to be 11.
11. Okay.
Yep.
So, in fact, Elaine and I were just working on the slides for Sanity. We're doing Sanity School this week, and we're working on the slides, and we're talking about kind of that middle school year age of modeling organization is kind of the second state. We direct organization when they're at the first level. At the second level, we want to model organization. So we want them to come up with organizational plans that work for them, and we model examples so that they can come up with ones that might work for them. But so you said ownership of schoolwork, and I'm going to push you a little bit to get specific and say, where is it breaking down? Is he having a hard time? Probably all, but is he having a hard time capturing the information? Is he having the hard time figuring out what to do when he gets home? Is he having a hard time finishing it once it gets done? Is he having a hard time turning it in once it's completed? Which one of those is going to be the most important place for you to take aim in terms of helping him to take the next level of ownership?
The biggest, you're right, he does struggle in all of those areas. I would say the biggest struggle and the one that I have the least influence and impact on is the writing down what his assignments are at school. So what does he need to get done? Which is why I go to that portal that says, here's your assignment and what grade you got on it. So that's the connection.
So capturing, so you want to take aim on capturing assignments. And, okay, great.
Yep.
So that's the one place, because you have the least influence. It happens when you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great.
Yep.
So, Mia, what about you? Where do you want to take aim?
That's a great question. I'd like to take aim on eating. So one of our persistent challenges, my daughter just turned 9. She also just broke 40 pounds. So she's very, very tiny, tiny kid. And she struggles to eat. It becomes a power struggle around getting her to consume enough food to not lose weight. And, of course, she's on medication for at least 4 hours a day, which suppresses her appetite. So just telling her to eat doesn't work very well. Just trying to come up with some better solution to getting her to
regularly. So is it about the struggles? Is it, Mia, is it about this decreasing the struggles? Is it about just getting her to eat, which feels like the more important
it's
one?
It's more about just getting her to eat. And okay. Because the struggles are, this sounds funny, but if we completely bribe with dessert and those things, but I know when I'm not there to say, hey, once you eat half your hamburger, you get ice cream, you know, it's not happening. So I need to I need her to be able to take ownership of fueling her body, you know, giving her enough fuel to run on, because I know her blood sugar correlates to her emotional meltdowns. That's part of my getting curious I've done before. So it's almost a perfect correlation. If she hasn't eaten anything, she's going to be really, really volatile. But getting her to connect, you know, oh, I'm feeling a little woozy. I need to eat something before I scream at everybody in the room. That's just not happening yet. And I know she's young. I don't know how to get over this without turning food into a battleground again.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay, great. So you both are really clear on where you want to take aim. Our conversation today is about curiosity. I'm on page 34 in the workbook. And, you know, I think this is a great topic for a lot of reasons. And I will self-disclose that this is one of the things that I love to work on, because curiosity helps me to manage my triggers. And if I can, and I always use curiosity, you know, they always say when we talk about the trigger management, we talked about the four steps of managing the threat cycle. The third step is choosing a different perspective. And the perspective that I like to take that kind of helps me to transition from being triggered to problem solving is curiosity. Because if I can go, okay, what's really going on here, either with me or with my kid or with the situation or the environment, it helps me to stay out of my story about the situation and into the problem solving enough, and helps me create that space between reacting and responding, if that makes sense. And so, you know, curiosity is literally asking what's going on. You know, you might ask, what is it that motivates my child? It might be what's in it for them. It might be what's going on with me. It might be I wonder what's going on at school right now, or I wonder what else is going on. But you're basically staying in a place of questioning rather than a place of fixing, which, again, it can help you manage your triggers because it keeps you in a place of curiosity. It can also keep you more open to problem solving. And our kids, a lot of times when we jump to fixing it for them and we skip a step, sometimes they shut down. So if they say, Mom, that guy is stupid, I don't want to hang out with him. You know, if we immediately jump to, oh, you should be nice to everybody, you can do it, you know, we go to fix it. If we don't stop and say, what's so hard about hanging out with this guy? We might shut down the relationship with our kids, and we might miss an opportunity to come up with a solution that might be completely coming from a different angle and might be much more successful. Curiosity, and especially when we do it verbally. So you can be curious and not say anything and just kind of wonder what's going on with your kid. You can also be curious and say, what's up, or what's going on. And sometimes they may not know. In fact, a lot of times they won't know what's going on, or they won't know why. And a lot of times as parents will say, why did you not turn in your homework? And that's like asking the dog, you know, why they're wagging their tail. They just are, you know, it's not an easy answer. But so sometimes we say it out loud, and sometimes we say it to ourselves. But it can be helpful just to say, what else is going on here, or what might be going on here? And the story I like to tell, I've got a family who is really dealing with meltdowns, 9-year-old daughter, and not Mia, but another family with a 9-year-old daughter really dealing with meltdowns. And they were just kind of scratching their head. It was to the point where they couldn't even eat dinner together because she was just so volatile. And so we did a curiosity exercise, and the curiosity exercise was a trigger journal. And that's kind of like, you know, you're getting curious and you're looking at what's going on. And they started tracking when the triggers would happen and how they happened. And they realized by being curious, they figured out that the meltdowns were happening more frequently when she was tired or when she was hungry. And so by staying in that place of curiosity, instead of just managing the meltdowns, they were able to kind of step back and go, okay, how can we find out more about what's going on here to be able to get to a place where we can prevent them? So then you start problem solving by keeping granola bars in your car, or making sure that everybody gets to bed at a reasonable time, or whatever it is that you can do to prevent the volatility instead of just managing the volatility when it comes up. So curiosity is a really great connector with our kids, and it's a really great support in terms of problem solving, and then it's also a good kind of in-between place to go when you find yourself reacting to be able to go, okay, wait a second, instead of just reacting, I want to pause and I want to respond or more broadly problem solve. So those are my thoughts about curiosity. Would love to hear from you guys what comes up as I share that.
This is Mia. I guess I love the story that very well could have been our family, because we did used to have a lot of those challenges until we realized, oh, wait, if you're really hungry, you can't stay calm. But I also know about myself, although my inquisitive scale is about the 100th percentile, when I'm mad, I have trouble being curious. So it's like it short circuits that ability for myself to be curious. So I have to manage my triggers really well to be able to get there.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, that's why it becomes the third step in the trigger cycle. So what are you doing, Mia, to reclaim your brain?
Yeah, I'm trying to basically pause, you know, the most basic strategy, pause and take a breath, that I don't have to instantly answer. Right now, mm-hmm. I can't walk away, but I can take a sip of water or take a breath before I say something I'm going to regret. And that can usually...
So how is that working so far?
It actually, I'm better than I thought. By taking away my ability to move, it's forced me to be more patient about a lot of things. So it's good discipline. You know, I always heard that yoga could teach you a lot of things if you just stuck with it. I've never been able to stick with it. But yeah, that creating the space to think and react. It's not perfect though, because yeah, I still yell at least once a day, but yeah, working on it.
So yeah, so there's all these steps. So Shelley said that she's a reformed yeller as well. Do you want to poke at this for a minute, since it's just a small group?
Sure.
Shelley, is that cool with you?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So step number two is reclaim your brain. Step number one is understand your triggers. So when are those moments that you tend to get more triggered, Mia?
I have two categories. One is when I feel like I'm being embarrassed in public. That's resulted in a lot of not shopping with my children, just especially when we're hungry. So it's more of a coping strategy than anything else. And realizing the people around me really don't care that my children are behaving like little demons. And so I probably shouldn't be so embarrassed by that. They're probably just grateful it's not their kids. But that's not, I still, you know, feel that sort of flush and emotional. But in the house where, you know, you would think I would have more control, it's when I feel like people aren't listening to me. So I've said it, you know, I've said the same thing multiple times, and I'm being ignored or shut out or whatever that situation is. And typically before, I would walk over, you know, try to make physical contact, make eye contact, you know, do those things to get attention. But right now I can't do a lot of that. So a lot of my tools have been taken away. So I find myself yelling to get attention. So I realize that's probably not the best strategy. But yeah, so those are
well,
my
and so my
triggers.
Guess is that you know, when you are more mobile, you'll use some of the tools to kind of get their attention in a different way. But my guess is that whenever you feel like you're not being heard, that tends to be a trigger for you. Is that fair?
Yeah, exactly. It's like a volcano sort of in my head. I feel like that rush of emotion. It's like, so this sounds odd, but sometimes it's so uncontrollable that instead of yelling at someone, I've just resorted to yelling, sort of the existential scream. That
yes.
Just like, I'm so frustrated.
Right.
I'm sure it looks
no,
insane.
And it makes sense. So you've got embarrassment on one hand, and you've got not listening on the other hand, and those are two feel.
Yeah.
So what's the feeling you get when your kids, you feel like your kids don't listen to you? What's the emotion underneath it?
I think frustration and anger. I build up the catastrophe in my head that if they don't listen now, if they don't get their teeth brushed, we're going to be late. We're not going to get in the car. I'm going to be late for work. I'm going to miss my first conference call. So I built up this whole catastrophe in my head. So it's frustration and angst that I'm failing. So I think ultimately it's a fear of failure and that my children are causing me to fail and not be
okay.
The best, whatever other role I have. So
there's two parts of this. There's the frustration
that's a lot to
put
and the. On them. That's not
no,
good.
It is. It is. And so there's frustration and the catastrophizing, and then there's the underneath it this fear of failure and this fact that if my kids aren't listening to me, then it's my fault and I'm the failure here. And
yeah,
does that okay? So Shelley, let's go to you for just a second. Mia's been working on this for a while, and I don't know whether you're in the same place as she is, but she's got a clear sense of the emotions that come underneath the triggers and the story she's telling herself with the triggers. Do you have the same awareness, or I can walk you through that a little bit?
Well, I know the thing that really triggers me and the thing that gets me going is that when I yell, it's usually because I have offered help. I've set something up. So if it's with the kids, maybe I you know, got all of their stuff out and ready for them, and then they don't do what I've asked them to do. Like I don't know how else to say it other than offered my help. I've done what I can to set you up, and now you're not using what I've set up. You're kind of like ignoring it, throwing it, you know, to the side, and that's the part that gets me worked up is feeling like I put in that effort for you.
Right, and then you aren't even going to bother to do it. I told you exactly what you needed to do, and then you're not going to do it. What are you? Are you an idiot? Are you? Am I banging my head against the wall? What's going on here? Okay, so what's the story you're telling yourself?
That they don't. To me, that is disrespectful, and that they don't value what I do. So I might as well not do any of it. I might as well just go in the corner and be
okay. And if you have disrespectful kids, what does that say about you?
Yeah, I'm sure it makes me question, you know, my abilities to parent them. Like, are they disrespectful to other people too? And what does the world see them as? Is it disrespectful?
So sit with it for just a second. Maybe take a deep breath with it, Shelley. Is it more about fear for their future and their ability to be respectful of other people, or is it more about I'm not being respected, and that says something about me?
That's a hard one. I do have a fear that I have to do this for the rest, like I'll have to do everything for them for the rest of their life. They won't learn to open their wings and fly. That is a definite fear of mine. But to me it is a very like to me, it's a very disrespectful. I don't feel loved if I do stuff for you and you throw it away. To me that says I'm not important to you. I have no value in your eyes. So Like,
well, and
that's
so for both of you, yeah, no, I think this is good because it's for both of you. There's both of these here. Mia, you said the same thing. And so let's get curious here because there's several layers. There's, you know, what's going on for your child in that moment when they're doing the thing that triggers you. There's the what's going on with me. And for both of you, it sounds like there's a fear for them. And then there's this underlying thing, and this is the gremlin piece of it that I talk about a lot. It's kind of like this, well, if only I was a good enough mom, I wouldn't, you know, I'd be able to know what to do in this situation. Or if, or maybe it's, you know, if I don't matter, you know, so it's a not good enough
yeah.
voice or whatever it is. And so there's a lot of times these, we don't need to go back and analyze, you know, the first time you felt this way, but it's kind of like a lot of these messages come back to some real, you know, experiences that we had when we were younger. It's like, you know, whether it was in your family or whether in other relationships. But so when you have that kind of joint trigger where it's about me and about them, it's important that you focus on both. It can be really helpful to focus on both because if you just stand there and go, okay, my kid is having a hard time showing respect, you still, that part of you that's pointing the finger at you and saying I'm not good enough or I'm doing something wrong will still linger and that'll make it harder to clear yourself of the trigger. Does that make sense and resonate for both of you?
Yep.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So if you understand that these are your triggers and you're doing the exercise to reclaim the brain, the third step is to change the perspective. So instead of, oh my gosh, they're never going to survive in life, I'm going to have to do this for them forever, or I'm catastrophizing about it, or that I'm a bad mom, what's an alternative? You know, so let's wait, hang on a second. Let's get curious first. So what do you think, in each of your situations, write something, take a little note here and say, what do you think is really going on for your child in that moment? Mia, what about for you?
Most frequently with my kids, when they're not listening or doing what I'm asking them to do, it's because they're really enjoying what they're doing. They're very engaged in it. They're maybe hyper-focused, you know, really heads down, doing a dot-to-dot, whatever. And they don't understand the contingencies. Like, okay, you need to stop that now so that we can do the next 17 steps so that you can get to school on time or to drama or, you know, whatever the next thing will be that they will also like. So they're just not seeing the connections yet because they're so in the moment, which is a really beautiful thing, but it's hard to interrupt. So
yeah. Okay. So they're engaged. They're hyper-focused. They're in the moment. Great.
Yeah.
What about you, Shelley? What about the moment for you? What? Where's your curiosity around them?
Well, I think what it is they don't see the value in it. They don't find it interesting, and they know that I'll do all of this stuff to get them ready for whatever it is that they're doing. You know, if it's their homework or whatever. It's just not important to them. They don't see any value in it. So even a fly on the wall would be more interesting than, you know, what I'm trying to get them to do.
So give me an example of something that they have a hard time with.
So like if they're getting their bag packed up for school the next day, you know, do I have all of my homework? Do I know which folder it's in? Do I have it all ready to go? Is everything packed up? Did I write down anything that I have to remember as a note, you know, turn this in or ask the teacher this? Do I have all my stuff together? And I go through that with them every night.
Okay, so you go through it with them every night and they've got this ritual. What's a realistic expectation at the level of development that they're at? Is it something they can do completely independently? Is it something that they need to have modeled? Is it something that they need to have directed? Where do you think they are?
Well, for Matt, I think he is capable of doing it because I've seen him do it before. He is capable. He does it better when I'm engaged with him So that's why I continue to do it every night. And my expectation isn't really that he would do it on his own ever, but I don't want it to be a battle. It's me, okay, now do you have this sheet out? And he, you know, nope, I don't. You know, it's like an argument. It's a fight. It's a fight to get him to do it. And so I think an expectation of him participating with me versus me, you know, I've got him on the leash and I'm walking him through it. I think he can, you know, walk with me. He doesn't, kind of like he doesn't need the leash anymore. That's my level of expectation.
So tell me what you think. So get curious about the frustration. He has a hard time doing it on his own, so he needs you to help. What do you think is really going on for him that it's hard for him to slug through each step?
Well, I thought it was the, like, the structure of it, like where he, you know, what he was using, the tool he had. But he created this tool now because I had worked on putting this binder together, and then in one of our conversations, it was, you know what, ask him, see what he wants.
Let me interrupt you for a second, because just because our kids create a tool doesn't mean necessarily that it'll work for them, because they don't know any better than we do kind of what's going to ultimately work. They can come up with ideas and try stuff, but you would think that he'd have a little bit more buy-in if he created it, but that doesn't mean it's sustainable. Does that make sense as a distinction?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So you were thinking that it was the structure that wasn't engaging for him. What else could be going on for him?
I don't know what else to say other than I know he doesn't value school. He doesn't value the reason why he likes school is because he can talk to his friends and be with his friends. That's it.
So what's his motivation to get his backpack? What's his motivation to get his backpack done?
For me to not hound him about it, for me to not be so annoying to him.
And how motivating, and I'm going to say this as unsarcastically as I can, how motivating is that for him at this stage?
Apparently not at all, because he still fights to do it.
Okay. So what we know about the ADHD brain and motivation is that the ADHD brain can do nothing without motivation, right?
Yep.
So how could you create some motivation for him around packing the backpack?
I don't know.
So I'm going to challenge this. I'm going to find the page in the workbook and go back to motivation here. Hang on a second. There's a page that talks about motivation and the different things that motivate the ADHD brain. What page are you on? Maybe we haven't done it yet. Hang on a second. I thought we had done it already. Humor. Why can't I find it? So there are five things that motivate. So it could be competition, it could be intrigue, it could be creativity/play, it could be, I can never remember them all off the top of my head. That's why I was looking for the page. But so if you're trying to figure out, it could be a reward, it could be, you know, something like that, but it's, if he doesn't have a motivation for doing it, it's going to be really difficult for you to get him going. Does that make sense?
Yeah. When does, I guess I struggle with, when does his independence and, like, the school part, like, my motivation is I have to get my schoolwork done. Like, I don't... Like, that part I don't get. When does that happen that's going to be the motivation? Is I have a job to do, and it's my responsibility to get my job done. Like, I don't know.
So is it there? Is it there yet?
What was that?
Is it there yet?
No.
Okay. So I don't mean to say this like this, but it's like, if it's not there, it's not there. You can model it. But the reality is that, you know, younger kids are often motivated by pleasing, And then they get to middle school and they don't care what anybody else thinks. They don't care what the teacher thinks. They don't care what mom thinks. They don't care what dad thinks. And so there's this lull in motivation. Some kids like kick in and go, I want to be the kid that does really well in school. I want to, you know, I've got a neighbor across the street and their daughter has always been motivated by being better than everybody else in her class. And she likes believing that she's the smartest kid in class, and it really motivates her to work really hard. Other kids don't ever get that. And so it's really more important to figure out what it is that does motivate him and help him to understand the role that motivation plays, and less about attaching to a certain motivation, because number one, it's going to take him longer to develop it. And then number two, we ultimately don't know what will motivate our kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So 38 is the page where we haven't gotten into yet. So 38 is the page where the five things that motivate: novelty, competition, urgency, interest, and then humor or play. I use the word play. So if you were going to try to pick one of these as a way to motivate him to get the backpack done, which one might you pick?
Probably humor.
Okay. So you make a game out of it. You make it fun. You laugh about it. You joke about it.
Yep.
He usually is more engaged. He's usually more engaged when I do that.
Like, just this last week we were doing the, like, I was trying to model for him how to use his binder in school and make sure he's writing down his assignments. And I was talking like I was a teacher in, like, a high-pitched, funny voice. And then when the bell would ring, I'd make funny bird sounds like that was the bell at school. And he was giggling about it, and he was actually participating. So I think that's probably the best way to engage him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's as simple as that, using funny voices, pretending we're at school, like he gets that gets him going.
Awesome. Okay. So let's pause there. Mia, let's look at your situation here. So we've got you're catastrophizing. You know that what's going on is that they're engaged, they're hyper-focused, they're intent in the moment. You like those things because it actually means that they're enjoying what they're doing. Knowing that and knowing that you can't physically go and break the energy and get their attention as easily, what do you think an alternative approach might be?
Actually, I was listening to you guys think through the reward thing. I have a slightly different point of view as well, because I do often get on my crutches and hobble over to break the energy to direct, you know, hey, next thing is let's go get dressed, you know, keep the routine going, guys. But I realize by being present, especially right now, and, you know, more closely monitoring, they're getting more attention from me if they're not doing their routine. So it's, I guess, kind of back to the basics of any attention is good attention. And if we don't, you know, if mom has to monitor us closely, she's standing in our bedroom with us while we get dressed. So I'm wondering if I need to shift the dynamics of that. Yeah, exactly, because my daughter used to be more independent in getting dressed. I'm wondering if I were to shift the dynamics of that, because I've dialed back the competition. We used to race, but then we were dealing with some sibling squabbling. So we dialed back the competition piece because that was maybe getting a little much. I'm wondering if once they're all ready for school, I can have a reward of some special time, you know, with me or with we got a dog. So let's try to teach Zip some tricks or something in our few minutes. If we're ready early, we have like 3 minutes before school where we can maybe do something fun as a reward rather than the time they spend with me is the time that I'm nagging. I'm reminding, you know, put your socks on. Sixth time, guys, put your socks on. But instead, because I know they know the steps. And if we make it more fun with a reward at the end, I'm sorry, I'm sounding really like I'm dragging. But, yeah, so that's just thinking, reframing it and wondering if I were to make the reward something that I intend to be a reward versus my presence or attention, which I don't intend to be a reward, but maybe acting as a reward right now.
No, it's great if you know that that's part of what they want, is they want the attention, so that when you get curious, you are aware of the fact that, wow, when I have to micromanage, I'm there. They like me being there. And so creating that, turning that into an incentive can be a really powerful thing. The other thing that kind of comes up for me as you're talking about this, and you're talking about, you know, engaged and hyper-focused and some of the other things that you used to use, physical touch to get their attention, it could be a really interesting conversation to say, okay, mommy can't easily come over and tap you on the shoulder, and that's what I usually do when you get really engaged in your game. What could we do instead that is going to get your attention, but it's not going to require me to get up off my crutches, off my couch, you know, and you could do some things like, it's like, I have this rock, I could throw it at you, that might work. What else can we do?
I might not hit what I intend to because I'm really not gifted that way, right? Yeah. So there, what are the
exactly.
choices? I suspect musical instruments will be suggested. I mean, the other piece of it too is just to turn off the voice in my head. The world's not going to end if we're 5 minutes late for school. It's, you know, it's not going to be the end of the universe. I have a cell phone. I can join calls from the car. So just shutting off.
Well,
that
and so thank you for bringing us back to that, because again, it's the curiosity of, you know, is this more about the story I'm creating, or is this more about the practical solution? And, you know,
yeah.
And I think that that's the hard thing for us to be, is kind of like, you know, when we look with curiosity and say, not just what's going on with my kid, but what's going on with me and why is this bugging me so much? Sometimes those things that we can control, like our mindset and our own perspective, can be easier. Sometimes they can't, but you know, it's just a matter of do I attack this practically, or from my child's point of view, or do I attack this from the way I'm looking at it? And so what you're saying is, how do I convince myself that the world's not going to end if we're 5 minutes late?
Yeah,
I'm on crutches after all.
Exactly. Right, yeah. You should be showing some compassion to, you know, the people. We're doing the best we can. It's not a normal week. So, yes, that perfectionist streak comes out at tricky times. But, yeah.
It does. So. It does, and it's pretty normal because that's, you know, part of what got you to where you are now, Mia, in terms of your success in life. So,
right.
that little voice in your head that drives you has been really great to you throughout your life. And sometimes it gets in the
way. Which I would like to say to Shelley, I don't think I had that voice as a child. I'm convinced my parents thought I would never have gainful employment or anything, because I sort of floated through school, including a lot of college. So some of us, it comes late, that motivation.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. And I would tell you this. It's like when you notice something – when you stay in that place of curiosity and you notice what does motivate your child, it can be really powerful. You know, it's like at some point I realized that my son, he's not in this place anymore, but he loved taking the bus. And so all of a sudden it was like, wow, sweetie, if you hurry up, you can take the bus this morning. You know, and it was like our lives changed, because he was like, oh, man, I really want to take the bus. I love the bus. It's so cool. And then the bus wore off, you know, and we needed to find another motivation. But it's you know, but that's what staying in a place of curiosity does for you, is that you're constantly looking for what is it that motivates, and not why is this not working.
Yeah. And what motivates them often surprises me, I will say. Yeah, because I'm like, why would you want me hovering over your shoulder? But, yeah, that's I think what's going on right now. So we'll try it out and see. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So
any other thoughts before we do our – wrap-up questions? Okay, so we are on, I skipped around in pages, so we're on page 35, which is the wrap-up for curiosity. So take a minute and answer the four questions. What did I pay most attention to or focus on today? What's my clarity or takeaway? What's the realistic action step for me to take? And how do I set myself up for success with the action? take a few notes, and I would love to hear from both of you. Ahas and commitments.
This is Shelley. I can start. I had jotted down a couple of things already. I think what I was paying most attention to and what caught me as sort of that aha was really getting down to the things that were triggering me and what those deeper meanings were. You know, we talked about the I'm not good enough and will my child succeed kind of thing. You know, really paying attention to everything that's behind the anger and the frustration. But I also just, you know, in our last part of our conversation had, I think, a little bit of a separate aha. I don't know if it's an aha, but I think one of my biggest areas are expectations. I do have high expectations, and I know it. But I also, my aha moment is that I don't know that I'm willing to adjust my expectations. And I know, I feel like I have to, but I don't feel I'm at a place yet where I'm comfortable doing it. And I think that stops me in a lot of the things that I'm trying to do with my boys. Because I look at not shifting my expectations, because I see it as lowering them, and I'm not okay with that. And I haven't gotten past the idea of just changing them slightly versus lowering them and what the difference is. And that's something I have to work on. As for an actual step that I can take, I'm not sure about that, but I think that is the area that I do need to focus on, because I think it'll trip me up no matter what I try to do. But I'm really stuck in what that means to shift my expectations, because I don't like the idea.
No, and that makes sense. So can I share an analogy that I like to use that might be helpful?
Yeah.
So if you had a child who was 6 months old and needed to have their legs cast, they had a broken leg or they had, you know, crooked legs or whatever, and you put them in a cast, and they were in a cast until they were 16, 17 months old, would you expect that at 18 months when they take the cast off that they could immediately walk?
No.
Okay. So what you're doing by shifting expectations is you're saying, I'm setting my expectations based on where my child is now and what the next step is of independence. So if the bottom step is completely dependent and the top step is where the same age peers are in terms of independence, if you stand up there and say, I want you to be up here, 6 steps up, 7 steps up, it's really hard for them to, that would be keeping the expectation at the level that they're at. What you want to do is you want to shift the expectation to say, what can they do every day consistently, independently? And yes, they can do it sometimes. And so that's an indication of potential success for the future. It doesn't mean that you can expect them to be able to do it every day. But what can they do now consistently, and what would the next level be? So, for example, with chores and things like that, maybe right now they can't do it without a regular reminder. Maybe the next step might be that they can do it with a visual reminder so that they can have a checklist that they go back to instead of you having to tell them each step. Maybe the step after that is that they create their own checklist. Maybe the step after that is they don't even need the checklist. You know, so you're figuring out what the expectation is relative to where they're at now, because you still want to challenge them to grow and to become more and more independent, but you're asking them to do that by learning the steps rather than expecting them to jump up from where they are to where they're not. Does that help?
Yep. No, that does make sense. That does make sense, absolutely.
So what might you do with that in this instance with Matt?
Well, I think what I need to do is, with this whole topic of curiosity, is understand why I have a problem with shifting the expectations. Because I know it doesn't make sense to expect them to go from, you know, step A to step Z. I know that, and that makes total sense to me. But why do I have a problem with adjusting my expectations? Like, what is it that makes me feel
okay.
that way?
So what is it? What's the voice in your head?
I think it goes back to that I'm afraid that my child is not going to be successful, and they're not going to succeed. They're not going to become independent. And so if I lower my expectations, I'm just helping them become less independent.
So you're enabling them, and that if I help them, that it's enabling them, and I really need to push them to just be as independent as possible. So how true is that, that there's no way for someone who's gotten help and support throughout their life to eventually become independent?
Well, everybody gets some support, so eventually they will.
Okay. And are you willing to consider that even if you give him some support, and an appropriate level of support, we aren't talking about, you know, dressing him and holding his hand through absolutely everything. You're still trying to help him to learn to be independent. Are you willing to consider that even with some additional support from you, he can eventually become independent?
Yeah.
Okay. And are you willing to consider that it's possible that more help in some areas might be a more powerful way to help him to be independent than less help?
Yeah. I can see that.
So, in that moment when you're afraid that your helping is going to lead to a life of dependency, which is what your voice in your head is saying, what do you tell yourself instead?
Maybe if I do help him more, he'll learn faster.
Yep.
You know, it
might goal in helping your goal in helping him is to help him to become independent.
Yeah.
And how does keeping that goal in mind as you are supporting him at 11 help to assure that he's going to blossom and bloom and grow through this process?
Yeah.
Shelley, this is Mia, and Diane, this is Mia. Just to chime in here, one of my more depressing scripts in my head is also that my kids will never be independent. They'll be living with me when they're 40 or something like that. And I started using one word when I'm talking to myself, which is yet. I can't do this yet. Just try to remind myself to put the yet on the end. It sounded really silly when I first started it. It was a suggestion from my daughter's teacher. But it's really helped me because it's short and easy to remember, and helps me remember, you know, we're still working on it. We're going to get there. Just not there yet. So,
love that.
In case that
I
helps
like
you
that. Too. No, I do. I like that.
Thank you, Mia. I appreciate that. All right, Mia, let's do your wrap-up real quick. What's an aha for you?
My aha is remembering to get curious, not just about my kids' behavior, but the stories I'm telling myself. So, make sure I'm attending to that because they can build up quite the dialogue in my own head that's causing me to act raise. To accept that sometimes we're going to slide back. You know, when things change, when I can't do the stuff I normally do, it looks like backward progress, but I just need to get curious again, even though I thought I solved this problem, so it's a little frustrating, but got to continually, you know, refresh the approaches. So that was kind of my aha. My takeaway, I'm sorry, I'm working without the workbook in front of me today, is to make sure I'm listening for those voices that are catastrophizing. I'm doing a lot of that right now because there's a lot of stuff I can't do.
Right.
And I'm making lists of things that aren't getting done right, which is not helping. So, you know, stop that script as much as I can, focus on what's going well, and try out the, hey, let's create a reward at the end of the routine. That's something, you know, once you guys have done your steps, you can come and maybe give Zip some treats. My dog might gain some weight, but that would probably be a good short-term solution to moving the attention to a different place. And yeah, so, and when I'm feeling overly frustrated, remember to get curious about, I think I said that already, I'm sorry, you know, what's going on with me, not just the kids. So
awesome, great. Well, this was a fun conversation, guys. I'm great call. Appreciate you both being honest and vulnerable. And we are, let's see, so from a schedule perspective, next week is Lifeline Call, and that'll be Thursday night at 8 Eastern Time, and then we'll meet again. We'll have 2 weeks, so there'll be 2 weeks off, and then the next meeting is the week of the 8th.
All right. Sounds great.
Sounds good.
Talk to you
soon,
guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
The moderator has left the conference. The conference is now completed. Goodbye.